Hey, it's Kirsten Diprose here for AgTech So What, brought to you by the Agthentic Group. This is a bonus episode. It's something new we're trying out and we'd love to hear what you think. You're probably wondering where Sarah is. Well, you're about to hear from her shortly. This is one of her recent talks about the future forces shaping food and agriculture. Sarah gave this talk at the Digital Innovation and Smart Agriculture Festival near my neck of the woods in Hamilton in beautiful Southwest Victoria. Here, Sarah outlines five forces impacting food and ag and how they'll be a catalyst for innovation and broader societal change. This talk is based on research Sarah and the Agthentic team did for AgriFutures, also with the help of the Institute for the Future. I'll let Sarah take the stage.
But I want to start with this picture and a little bit of a story around innovation. So if you see the picture on the left and the picture on the right, these are both New York City. One is in 1905. And one is in 2015. And of course, on the left, you see horse-drawn carriages, and on the right, you see cars. But that is not the story of disruption that I want to tell you about today. It's a story of disruption you've probably heard before. What I want to draw your attention to is if you look closely, you'll see it's not just the type of vehicle that's on the road that distinguishes these two photos. It's how our whole lived experience has changed as a result of the automobile. So it's the network of traffic lights, it's parking spaces, it's shrunken sidewalks, it's automobile-oriented businesses, car dealerships that we see now that we didn't have in the past. Today, over half of modern American cities' land is dedicated to streets and roads and parking lots and service stations and all these things that exist now as a result of the automobile. So it's the infrastructure that stemmed from this initial disruption that's changed. And it's not just in major metropolitan cities. We see freeways and fueling stations, parking lots, drive-through foods. In the US now, something like 20% of meals are eaten in the car, which obviously wasn't possible previously. We didn't have drive-throughs. So what I want to highlight here is how one initial technology can cause a whole change over a period of over 100 years to the infrastructure in how we live. And really, this is happening, this same transformative power of automobiles that was unlocked through these infrastructure linkages is similar to what's happening today. We're seeing technology, digital technologies, transform our world and transform food and agriculture. What's again happening is not just this one initial technology, it's not just sensors, it's not just artificial intelligence, but it's actually that these technologies are transforming the infrastructure, this connected infrastructure around how we live and operate. So we're seeing massive growth in internet connected devices. Of course, many of you have one of those in your pocket that now helps us order transportation or food or organize our farms or lives. We're seeing growth in artificial intelligence, including in agriculture, and growing computing power and resources behind that that are enabling us to grow these technologies and the infrastructure that sits around them. And this is one of the many forces that we see impacting agriculture. We call this interconnected digital infrastructure. It's just one thing shaping our world today, inside and outside of food and agriculture. These interconnected systems of digital capabilities that are playing out across the ag supply chain. So as you heard before, I'm Sarah Nolette, and I'm the co-founder of the Agthentic Group, and our mission is to enable innovative agriculture for global impact. We spend all of our time across Tenacious Ventures, our venture capital firm, investing in early stage startups, building this future, and Agthentic Advisory, our advisory firm where we work with industry bodies, government, and private companies on building the future of the food system through innovation, technology, and sustainability, and our podcast, AgTech So What, where we tell the stories of non-traditional innovators. All of this means we spend 100% of our time thinking about the future of agriculture. And so while I was going to talk to you today about some specific technologies and some of the opportunities we're seeing, I actually think that focusing on technology alone misses what I think is the bigger picture and a much more important message for Hamilton and for all of you to hear today. So while I can't predict the future, what we're starting to see is signals of what it might look like. And it's really clear that technology is just one tiny piece of what we'll need and what we'll need to be ready for in the future. Because interconnected digital infrastructure is just one of the many forces impacting the world around us. There's at least four others that we found in some recent work with AgriFutures. And I want to talk to you about how these forces are shaping the world around us, including in food and agriculture. So first I'll go through each of these forces And then I'll talk a little bit about what you can do, whether you're a producer, an entrepreneur, a policymaker, or just someone who lives in and around Hamilton who might eat food every now and then to thrive in this increasingly complex future. So we've talked about interconnected digital infrastructure. Let's have a little bit of a look at the other four. This second force we call viral disinformation in the food system. Now, this is things like new communications and media technologies that are making our world, but especially our food system, more susceptible to manipulation. Things like deep fakes, so videos that are designed by computers and technologies to look like a real person is speaking, but it's not actually the real person and they didn't say any of those words. Or social media campaigns like we've seen to influence elections. So these are deep technologies that are influencing how we receive information and what kinds of information we trust. Now, in food and agriculture, propaganda is not new, but there's a couple new things with this force that we're seeing. The speed and efficiency with which these impacts can happen, the range of actors who can access these technologies. We all have smartphones now, we all have social media. And so it's not just big companies with multi-million dollar budgets who can spread viral disinformation in the food system or otherwise. It's much more accessible than that. And this democratization means a lot less control of the impacts. This is happening globally. People are worried about who to trust. 66% of people worry that technology will make it impossible to know if what we're seeing or hearing is real. Just think about that. Not knowing what you see or hear is real. It's absolutely crazy. And it's happening in Australia too, where one of the top five countries that has seen a big drop in trust in technology in just the last 2 years. So there are, of course, opportunities to use these technologies for good. It's not all doom and gloom, but we also need countermeasures to build immunity to these attacks and to make sure we build trust, especially in food and agriculture, with our consumers. That's at the local level, the brand level, at the national level. So there's many opportunities here we see with this force. The third force is what we call new geographies of climate change. So you guys would be no strangers to climate volatility. We've seen it across Australia for many years with droughts and bushfires, the climate volatility increasing the frequency and severity of extreme weather events. And in response, plants and animals and people will need to adapt. And migration, like you see here, is one strategy. We're already seeing this, and I'm sure you guys have many examples in the room there about where what wine varieties we can grow in certain regions are shifting or moving cotton production into the Northern Territory, or places that might only have a summer crop also gaining a winter crop, or vice versa, or having both. So there's lots of opportunities here with how what we grow and where we grow it is changing. Internationally, we're seeing this especially in fisheries, which I think is a fascinating example. Fish stocks are moving as a result of climate change and water temperatures. And this raises questions about if you have a quota for a fishery and the fish aren't there anymore, can you fish in other jurisdictions? And if you do, what happens to the processing assets that you had near that fishery, or are there international jurisdiction issues? So there are opportunities here, but there are also massive challenges that aren't just about technology, that aren't just about climate. They span business and partnerships and social networks, because this future, and even just this force, is increasingly complex. So again, there are many opportunities here to capitalize on newly suitable regions, to grow new and different things, to capture new revenue streams. There'll be continuous adaptation and innovation required. And again, that in itself is an opportunity. The fourth force we see is what we call rewiring the grid. And this one maybe spans a bit outside of agriculture, but has an increasing impact on agriculture and regional communities. And this is really about energy, accelerating the shift away from fossil fuels and towards renewable and alternative energies. This is being driven both by social pressure and economic forces. So big companies now and governments have pressure on them from investors, consumers, and all of us to accelerate that transition and be more environmentally and socially friendly. These compliance requirements from the big capital providers are driving new investments in these systems. And that means we'll see more distributed energy, because a lot of the potential for storage and for land is not in big cities where we've already occupied the land, but will actually be much more distributed. And this is an opportunity for regional communities, but it's also completely different than what we have today. And the final force that we see is what we call domesticating the cell. This is about the field of synthetic biology and our ability to design and engineer biological processes. it's still in the early days, but we're seeing huge potential and lots of money, $3 billion in 2017 and nearly $7 billion in 2019 invested into animal and plant biotechnology. And a lot of this goes to our ability to control the cell. Some of this is familiar applications like engineering plants and animals for desirable traits like we have for many years and we've been improving in our biotechnology spheres in agriculture. Some of it extends to capabilities across the supply chain, things like engineering sensors and food, biopackaging and biobuilding materials. So it means that our production practices and our supply chains and even our food will completely change as this field matures. And again, this creates opportunities. But unlocking this potential depends on social acceptance and trust. And this is a good example of where these forces can interrelate. When we have misinformation in the food system going viral and this new capability to domesticate the cell, how do we control these narratives and how do we ensure we have trust with consumers of these new technologies that we might use in agriculture? So these are the forces that we're seeing. And again, from viral disinformation to interconnected digital infrastructure to new geographies of climate change, rewiring the grid and domesticating the cell, they're all intersecting and playing out simultaneously. Now, I'm not here to predict the future, but what I can tell you is that these forces are happening in different ways all over the world, here in Australia, inside and outside of food and agriculture. And some of that's really scary, but hopefully some of it is really exciting. And the key, as I see it, is that we have an opportunity, and everyone in this room has this opportunity, to plan for the complex challenges that we'll face tomorrow. This is farmers and industry leaders that we speak to all the time are already seeing these changes and already doing this. Like this quote from a horticulture farmer in Victoria that we talked to throughout this report highlighting these forces, who just believes that we really need to plan for the future, not based on what we've done in the past, but based on these emerging complex challenges that we'll see in the future. And it's that word complexity that really is key for me, because this increasing future, the intersection of these forces and all these new technologies, means that the strategies and tactics that have gotten us to where we are today just might not be enough to thrive in the complex future. But again, I see this as a huge opportunity. I see it as an opportunity to think about new value chains, to think about new infrastructure and the implications for our regional communities and our cities and our farms, to think about new identities, what it means to be a farmer, to participate and work in food and agriculture, new ways of working, new ways of eating. So for each of these, I'll tell you an example or a story of someone, company or technology or farmer already doing this today, and some of the signals of what the future might look like in each of these five areas. So first, new value chains. What are we seeing here? Well, I want to tell you about Fiona Aveyard. Fiona is a fifth generation farmer in Tullamore, New South Wales. She and her husband, Bill, run a pretty traditional mixed farming enterprise of over 7,000 acres. But a few years ago in 2017, Fiona started looking around the regional community in Tullamore. She saw that the presence of kids in the schools were declining, people were moving away, there was pressure to consolidate, you know, pretty traditional story that we unfortunately hear too much in regional communities. And she said, well, why can't we use what we do here, producing incredibly high-end food and fiber, and particularly our lamb, to see if we can do something better for our community? So she decided to make a lamb sausage roll using what she produces on her farm, their fat lambs, and took them to the local, I think it was a football game, 1,000 lamb sausage rolls. And they sold out right away. Everyone gave great feedback. And for her, it just started to change her thinking around who actually is the customer for our product? What do they actually want? And do we need to sell it in the same ways that we've always sold it previously? Or are there new opportunities to think of different supply chains and different end consumers? So she continued that research, continued growing out the Outback Lamb brand, experimenting with different products and learning more about her customers. Initially, as she explored distribution channels and retail, she thought the people buying would be people like me sitting in Sydney, maybe wanting high-end products or paying a bit more for food. What she found was actually it was people in her local community, and they wanted things that she didn't actually think they would, like preservative-free products or sustainable packaging. So that ability to get closer to who her consumers actually were started Fiona thinking about what she actually produces, how that might impact the farm, how that might impact the Outback Lamb brand. And now as she expands local sales as well as retail and distribution channels and online sales, she's creating whole new value chains for that lamb product. For her, that's meant she's taking a $250 carcass to over $400 per animal. So a 60% increase in carcass value. And she's really early on this journey. It's only a small percentage of her lamb that she sells in this new value chain, but it's an example of how value adding can start and how that focus on who your customer is can start to change what the business looks like. Now, Fiona is just one example. There are many more on a macro scale of these new value chains and this trend about getting closer to consumers. So a few things we're seeing globally. One, in the top left, you see Purdue Farms, a massive manufacturer in the United States. They've developed their own meat brand, and they're using data that they collect as well as partners that they buy data from to understand their consumers and build new products suited to them. So this is different kinds of packaging, different kinds of cuts of meat, different kinds of brands that they're creating. So getting closer to consumers, again, through that data, it's having an impact on the upstream supply chain. And companies like Chipotle in the bottom left, a quick service restaurant in the US, during COVID launched an online farmers market where they were not only selling their burritos like they always do, but also produce from farmers and highlighting who those actual farmers were. And they gave those farmers free onboarding. And again, using those consumer insights that they get from working with customers every day to help farmers produce products that consumers want more of and give them a new channel to access them. And finally, Barn to Door, which you see in the middle, is a company that gives a turnkey solution for producers like Fiona to go on this journey of selling direct to customers. So you don't have to set up your own website and deal with all the different technology, but you can get started right away and connect with consumers. So what all these examples mean? Well, one, getting closer to consumers matters, and that's changing how our value chains operate and the roles of producers. That role might increase. You might get more involved with your supply chain. Now, that might look like selling direct to consumer, but it might look like on-farm storage or getting more involved in trading or just thinking in different ways about who the end customer is and what it is you're producing for them. It also means that food brands like Chipotle and Purdue are coming upstream in the supply chain, getting more engaged with producers and influencing or attempting to influence how and what's produced. So this is just one example of what we're seeing and opportunities to take advantage in the future. The next one is new infrastructure. And I want to tell you about a company called GoTerra. Olympia, the founder, moved back from the US and started looking at the livestock industry. She'd worked in agriculture previously and wanted to get back into livestock, but kept seeing that feed costs were increasingly expensive and thought about opportunities to create more sustainable feed at lower cost. And through a long journey, she landed on insects, exploring the possibility of insects to be livestock feed. And she realized that we're still a long way from that in terms of the regulations and proving that out. But what we're not far away from at all is insects, and particularly black soldier flies or maggots, being able to manage waste. Any of you that have a compost bin in your backyard know how this can happen. So the maggots can manage waste, but they need to do that in a controlled environment. No one wants compost bins with maggots crawling over it anywhere. So by building technology, fully temperature controlled automated units that can manage the biological process, the maggots consuming the food waste, Olympia has built a business called GoTerra that takes all kinds of organic food wastes. The maggots in the robot eat them, and out the other side, you not only have waste diverted from landfill, but you have potentially livestock feed, pet food, and even human food, depending on what's produced and consumed. But one of the things Olympia realized on the way is that waste is really hard. When we think of waste and when waste gets talked about in the media, we kind of think about it like this picture on the left. These clean organics, you know, a pile of tomatoes or apples sitting there looking all the same. But in reality, waste looks a lot more like this picture in the middle. This is an actual bin load coming to GoTerra from one of their clients. Doesn't look like there's very much food there. You guys can tell. It's a lot more plates and chopsticks and forks and things like that. So this is really what waste looks like. And actually even can look like this. These are things that GoTerra has actually seen and processed in their facility. Nappies, forks, plates, bones, some kind of dinosaur bone even. It's come from one of the restaurants where they manage the waste for. And so what Olympia realized is we need new infrastructure. We can't just think about changing consumer behavior because all of us don't want to go through the work of separating out different kinds of food waste. And so while that's something maybe we could aspire to change, what's actually going to be more impactful is building new infrastructure. So this is one of the GoTerra units. This one is sitting in the basement of Lendlease in Sydney, managing all of the waste from that building and some of those things you saw in the previous pictures. And it's just one example of the kinds of new infrastructure that we're seeing in this future. And the kind of new infrastructure that's possible to have a positive impact on climate change because it diverts waste from landfill, and it starts to rethink our value chains because these are decentralized units. We're not trucking waste out to a landfill, which can be massively important because our landfills are filling up. And for some cities, there isn't room to put in any more. But this is just one kind of new infrastructure, and we're seeing this happen in all kinds of other ways. For example, with COVID, we saw a decline in a retail presence globally, and that's led to what we call dark stores, or these warehouses that don't have any kind of retail presence, but exist only to fulfill that last mile delivery. So whole new infrastructure, whole new facilities that didn't exist before to serve a whole new supply chain. We also see that with companies like James Tyler, basically a near real-time supply chain straight into Asia that digitally links consumers overseas with the physical infrastructure here to supply those consumers, and does that all through software and automation. And we're seeing that on our farms. We're seeing more capital and more innovation flow into robotics and the ability to pick fruit or map orchards or detect mummy nuts or do automated spraying. And when we talk about this, yes, we think about the technology itself and maybe it's far away or maybe it's not. But when we talk about new infrastructure, what I would highlight is that as these technologies evolve, which they will and quickly, we actually start to rethink about infrastructure. So what should the farm look like? Should we have trellis trees? How far should they be spaced apart? Do we need new dwarfing varieties? What does the whole infrastructure of the farm look like and how we operate it when these technologies are possible? So this entrance of new infrastructure and the impacts that we'll have means we can optimize production systems for these new automated supply chains. We can think about redesigning regions to access more of these physical assets or take advantage of these changes in consumer trends. And we'll need new skills and jobs to operate this new infrastructure that might exist in very new geographies, including on farms. Now, another aspect, we've talked a little bit about technologies, but this complex future will also question traditional roles and identities of what it means to work in agriculture and to be a farmer. So I have two stories here. On the left, you see a farmer named Murray Scholes, and he farms with his wife, Emma, in southern New South Wales on the foothills of the Snowy Mountains. And they've largely, for most of their time, been grain producers. But a few years ago, Murray went to Switzerland, and he was walking through the beautiful Swiss Alps and saw, to his surprise, a few farms. Now, these are farms with like two cows or one cow. And you know, he thought, how could these possibly be commercial farms that actually supply milk to anyone when they only have less than five cows? And what he realized was the government was actually paying these farmers to perform this service of creating this beautiful, iconic Swiss landscape. And so they actually have a different revenue stream. In addition to maybe their milk sales, they also have this income stream of producing this benefit for society. And that got Murray thinking about, well, what is he not producing today that he could be producing? Or what kind of identity of himself and of their farm might he need to challenge? And he started looking across his farm, and one of the big problems he was having was herbicide resistance in his grain operation. He was trying everything, different kinds of optical spraying technologies and different chemicals and cocktails and timings, and just nothing was working. And he had always said his whole life that he just didn't want to farm sheep. He's a grain guy, and that's what he wants to farm. But he started to look over at his neighbor who did have sheep, and they were running them in the crops to eat the weeds. And that was helping with the weed management problem. And so a couple things just clicked into place, and Murray said, well, I guess I need to become a sheep producer. And so he did bring sheep into the operation, got someone on board to manage them, help with the weed problem, and created a new revenue stream. And this, going all the way back to his journey to Switzerland, was unlocked because of a change in his identity. He'd always wanted to be a grain producer, but now he's a mixed farmer, and they also run beef cattle as well as those prime lambs. So that's one example of this change in identity that this complex future can drive. Stu Austin and his family on the right here were in the news a bit recently. You might have heard of them. They just sold $500,000 in carbon credits to Microsoft. Yes, that's Microsoft that makes Teams, the software that I'm dialing in on today. And they bought carbon credits from his farm in New South Wales that he produced and monitored and measured using technologies like FarmBot and Maya Grazing. And this is another example of farmers creating whole new revenue streams based on new technologies, new markets, new demands from consumers that starts to challenge the identity of what it means to farm. Is he a carbon producer or is he a livestock producer? Well, actually, he's both. And those aren't the only examples. We're also seeing brands such as General Mills branding their products as regen and creating new supply chains and new premiums based on different kinds of production practices that they're increasingly getting involved in to help farmers capitalize on these opportunities. And we're seeing venture-backed companies such as Nori, which is based in the US, and they're a marketplace that sells carbon credits. So it's not just the Australian carbon credit unit system, but we're seeing players like the Microsoft deal, others like Nori, enter this market to create new opportunities for farmers. And it's not just in this technology or carbon or sustainability space, we're also seeing it with energy, things like agrivoltaics integrated with livestock operations. But also farmers will require broader skill sets to manage their businesses, to get involved in these different opportunities. Do they do it themselves and upskill and how, or do they outsource it and have other help in the business to take advantage of some of these opportunities? And I think the most interesting one is that the actual identity of what it means to be a farmer might evolve or get challenged. We talk all the time in agriculture about being a fourth generation or fifth generation livestock producer. But when you're also a first generation solar producer, what does that mean for who you are, how you introduce yourself? And that could be challenging, but also creates massive opportunities for new skills and talent and perspectives to come into our farms and to come into our regional communities. And this also means opportunities for novel and interdisciplinary research. Yes, you know, do sheep want the shade under the solar panels? That's something that MLA is looking at, but also things like if you have a wind turbine on your farm and it's vibrating and shaking the soil, does that mean that you've got new opportunities for biological inputs that can grow crops better and sequester more carbon? I don't know. We haven't done that research because we haven't thought about these complex interrelated systems with energy production and food production and new types of revenue streams. And we also need to look at new ways of working. These forces are unlocking entirely new ways of doing business and of farming. This is one example in Queensland that you might have heard of, a company called Swarm Farm Robotics. They were founded by Andrew and Jossie Bate. Now, Andrew and Jossie are farmers. They were largely broadacre farmers out in Emerald in Queensland. And they saw that they were hitting the ceiling of expanding their farm, just needed to get bigger and bigger, bigger equipment, more staff, more acreage, and said, I'm not sure we want to be on this treadmill. Maybe there's a better way. And they felt like the unlock code for that was automation. So instead of being farmers, they've pivoted to also be entrepreneurs, venture-backed company called Swarm Farm that is building autonomous agricultural vehicles. Some of the different applications you see here, like spraying and spreading and mowing. This is one example of autonomy and robotics coming into agriculture. And it does a few different things. Well, for example, with spraying, yes, we can have optical spraying. We can have spot spraying that can run 24/7. It can go in different conditions. It can stop when there's weather incidents to prevent spray drift, all kinds of benefits for how we farm and how the economics of that can work to unlock precision ag practices that just weren't possible before without robots. But also new ways of thinking about premiums. The turf farm in the bottom right that you see, the robots mowing. And in normal cases, you would never have someone mow 24/7. It's too expensive. When it rains, the field gets wet and the machine would get bogged, et cetera, et cetera. But with a robot, it can run 24/7. So we start to see automation unlocking new ways of working, new ways of thinking about inputs. Maybe instead of spraying or optical spot spraying 24/7 or otherwise, we go around slowly with a robot and chip away at the weeds. Or maybe we have a microwave technology, and because we've mapped the field, we can go target the weeds pre-emergence with a microwave. So this is just one example of technology and new ways of thinking, unlocking fully different ways of farming. And we see that in other areas of automation, like with robotic dairies, but we're also seeing that with things like biodegradable sensors, which is what you see here at the bottom. Thinking again about that domesticating the cell force that we talked about before, these are biodegradable sensors that are 3D printed and can be planted along with your crop. Now they can detect things throughout the season and then they biodegrade. No need for maintenance, no need for anyone to go out and fix it. And they don't all need to work because there's basically one everywhere. So you're getting that level of precision, that level of understanding of each individual plant and each sample of soil. Now I have one more for you. And this one, we've talked a lot about the upstream to technologies, and we've talked a lot about the farm. But I want to talk a little bit about food and how these forces are creating opportunities and challenges for whole new ways of eating. Now, you might have heard of cellular agriculture or lab-grown meat, as others call it, or cultured meat is another term for it. It's basically real meat made without the animal. So what these companies are doing, and this is an example from one based in Sydney called Vow, is they isolate cells from an actual animal biopsy. They figure out which ones will grow. They store them in a library. They accelerate their growth through cultivators. And about 6 weeks later, they can produce different food products. Now, many of these companies, and you might have heard of some of them, are trying to compete with existing animal species. They're trying to make a burger or a schnitzel or something like that taste just like the meat we normally eat does, but made from these lab-grown processes. But Vow's taking a different approach. They've said, well, why would we compete with meat that we all eat? And why would we assume that the tastiest thing to eat was actually the easiest to domesticate? So Vow's approach is to start with any animal, and you see some of them there. Maybe it's a zebra, or maybe it's a turtle. So some of the food that they've created is not maybe what you'd expect. They've got a goat cheeseburger slider. They've got pork and prawn cutlet. They've got kangaroo crystal dumplings, alpaca chili, rabbit tart with peas and mushrooms, or a lamb glassy scallop. So different kinds of examples of food challenging the traditional categories of what we think, that a burger is made with hamburger that comes from cows. And this is what I want to highlight, because this is what Vow is just one example of, the blending of these different products, whether that's cellular agriculture and traditional meat, like we see with the pork and prawn cutlet, where the pork maybe comes from cell ag and the prawn comes from actual prawns, or even rethinking flavor and form and how they relate, like the lamb glassy scallop. Well, maybe it's lamb grown in a lab, but the texture is actually like a scallop. So completely mind-blowing stuff that we can do as we precisely control the inputs at this level. And there's a few other examples. In the bottom, we're seeing already gone to market in the US by Tyson Foods, a blended beef burger. So the benefits of plant-based burgers, however you might think about them, with the benefits of beef-based burgers combined into one, targeting flexitarians who might want to lower their intake of beef. So a blended product that's already on the shelves in the US. But breaking these boundaries doesn't stop there. We also see examples like in the middle, we have a chicken spinach leaf. So this is a spinach leaf that's been decelled to become the scaffold or the bones on which these cell ag products can grow, in this case, chicken. So it's mind-blowing, right? We've got spinach that tastes like chicken that's grown in a lab. And it's just one example of how we're challenging the traditional categories of what it's meant to produce something and grow something and have it end up in consumers' hands and they think of it in a certain way. That doesn't need to exist like that in the future with these new technologies. And the last example in the top left is intersecting this food capability and precision synthetic biology capability with medicine. So Viome is a company that's making food recommendations based on their analysis of your actual microbiome. So starting to connect this control at the cellular level and your need for food with medicine and health at a very precise individual level. Now, these new ways of eating create opportunities for premium supply chains, for new markets to participate in, but that's challenging. You know, what are the feedstock for these industries? Who's supplying these cell ag industries? Who's processing that? Where do those processing facilities exist? There's also an importance of branding and communication with consumers. These are complex products, clearly. So who's talking about them in ways that are authentic, that aren't susceptible to viral dis and misinformation? And it has implications for the whole organization of our food and ag system, everything from research to extension that's often built along commodity lines. But these commodity lines are blending and blurring at the consumer end. And so what does that mean for our whole research system? Now, of course, we cannot predict the future, and that's not what I was attempting to do today. But hopefully these examples help you appreciate how the future is changing, how it's becoming more complex. And I challenge all of you, or invite all of you, to think today about ways to participate in new value chains, to think about new infrastructure and how it's changing the world around us, to challenge or think about new identities and what that means for new perspectives coming into food and agriculture and into regions, to consider new ways of working and even new ways of eating. But none of this is up to me. It's definitely up to you guys. So I'll leave you with, what do you want the future to look like? Does any of this resonate with you? And do you see ways, whether you're a farmer, an entrepreneur, a policymaker, to get involved and take advantage of some of these intersecting forces and this complex future? Hopefully you do. Thank you so much for your time.
And that's it for a bonus episode of AgTech So What. You can find a link to the Future Forces report Sarah was referring to in the show notes. And just for the sake of transparency, a few of the companies mentioned in this talk are funded by Tenacious Ventures, which is the sister VC firm of Agfentic. Those companies are GoTerra, Swarm Farm Robotics, and Nori. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.